So we moved from the Soto office to the Columbia building downtown. And that was also not a very fancy building, but the landlords really didn't want to have any pets in there.
That building was awful. They had no right banning anything from
that
building.
I know, but but they really didn't want to have pets in there, and there, you know, fears of liability if someone got bitten, and you know, those things. So the landlords asked Amazon to sign a waiver to hold them harmless if anything happened because of the dog. Now, the funny thing is, then Jeff asked us, Susan and I, to sign a waiver so that Amazon would be harmless.
This episode is sponsored by Rebellion Defense. Rebellion was born to put the power of cutting-edge software and artificial intelligence, machine learning, into the hands of those who protect and defend the United States, the United Kingdom, and our allies in this software-centric national security era. To learn more, visit rebelliondefense.com. Today, I'm excited to be talking with Eric Benson, who was one of Amazon's earliest software engineers. In earlier podcast interviews, his name came up a lot as he played a part in or drove many of Amazon's most impactful features. Eric and his wife, Susan, who led Amazon's editorial team, and their dog, Rufus, were three of the favorites amongst early Amazonians for not only their contributions at work, but also because they all three of them had very warm personalities. Eric's going to share several stories about what it was like building and inventing things from scratch in the midst of insane customer growth, and how staying focused on making customers happy, which might just simple as that, focusing on making customers happy, enabled the team to keep moving forward during that chaos. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you. So you joined in 96, which was very early. You know approximately what Ember engineer you were? Just to put things in perspective?
Engineers, let's see. One, two, three. I think I was maybe four or five.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. So very early.
Yeah.
And so today we're going to talk about several early software engineering projects that you led or participated in. But I'd like to start with the story of Amazon's multi-day outage in 1997, because I don't think that's been mentioned yet. It was supposedly very bad. Do you remember anything about that, or what can you tell me about it?
It was in early 97, and so it was about a year after I started, more or less. And I recall it was several days. Well, like you say, I think about 3 days, but what I recall is that we had a hard database crash, that our database server crashed such that we could not run the database, and therefore we couldn't run the store. And we had Oracle engineers on site trying to solve the problem. And it was, we were sweating. And, I think a lot of internet sites in the early days had those kinds of troubles. But it was the longest outage that we had, I think, ever, once we really got
going.
This
was basically customers got a 404, essentially?
Yes,
or they got,
yes.
There was no website.
Come back later, yeah, right, exactly.
Right. And in those days, did it threaten the company? Like, what would have happened if it, like, I'm assuming we recovered everything, because it would be a different story that we would have all heard about if they had to restart from scratch, but...
Yeah, I can't say for sure that we recovered everything, but we did recover at least most, probably close to all of the data that we had. I know personally, because my order history goes back before that outage. So, yeah.
That's funny. I lost mine because there was a point in the old days, you probably remember, where you could have multiple accounts with the same email address passwords.
Yes,
yeah, and at some point they got rid
of
that.
Right,
so I lost the first few years of my history. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't participate in fixing it. You were there experiencing it.
Correct. I was a spectator. I think Bob Vadney, who was one of our he had sort of adopted learning about the database after he'd been there for a little while. And so he was working with the Oracle engineers there, trying to get things back online.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I know there are famous stories about eBay having outages even later than that.
Oh, yes.
The only question I have for it is, was it not common practice to have backups of things like that back then? Is this a silly question, or was it even more extreme than that?
It's not so much a matter of having a backup or not. It's a matter of having the server running. I mean, so we wouldn't have had an entire backup server. We would have maybe backup tapes, or, you know, probably tapes at that time. So that we could restore onto a server from backup tapes. But then you would have to have an entire server ready to go that you could just switch over to. So no, we didn't have anything like that at the time.
Because back then we only had one database server. Is that true?
Yes, I'm pretty sure. At least when we definitely only had one customer database at that time. And really, that was almost everything. Right. There were some auxiliary databases, but that was the only thing that really mattered, was the customer database.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard similar stories that the eBay crashes were just as drastic, where they could have had to start from scratch, you know, and rebuild everything, which for them may have been even more devastating because it was later on and they had all those reviews and ratings for all the sellers and purchase history and all that sort of stuff. It would have been difficult.
Yes, they had serious problems. And in fact, I think that was one of the reasons for Amazon's drive to do auctions, was that we thought eBay was vulnerable because their technology was so rickety, right. Basically unstable. Yeah.
Yeah. What we weren't aware of is the power of network effects in auctions and a bunch of other things.
Yes.
Side topic.
Well, it's a whole, that's worth a whole show on its own, but yeah.
So then backtracking, you joined in 96, about a year before that outage. How did you get to Amazon? And I'm not asking this with every guest at this point, but it's interesting because you came with a few very early, and you worked with a few of the very early employees before Amazon. So I think it's interesting.
Yes. Shel Kappen, who was the first engineer at Amazon and who was mainly responsible for building all the IT infrastructure, basically all the software that led to the store opening in June of 95. I had worked with him at three companies previous to Amazon. So I had worked with him at Lucasfilm for a little while, and at Lucid, which was a small software company that I had founded for several years. And then I worked with him at Kaleida Labs, which is an IBM and Apple joint venture. And that was just previous to Amazon.
Right. And JJ Jacoby was there as well. Is that Amazon employee?
Yes.
JJ was an early engineer, TPM, I think more so, when she joined Amazon.
Well, no, she was an engineer. She came in as a manager, I think,
like a software manager.
First level manager.
Yeah, and she's back again. She couldn't get enough.
Right.
And it was actually Susan, your wife, who got recruited and not you. Is that
well,
right?
Well, not exactly. The way it happened was Shell sent an email to people he knew in the Bay Area saying, oh, Amazon is hiring people. We have these positions available. And at the time, I wasn't really looking for anything, but I noticed that one of the positions on his email was managing editor. And Susan and I were both at that time working at Netscape in Mountain View. And I saw that job, managing editor, and I thought, oh, you know, maybe Susan would be interested in this. And I wasn't really thinking of myself at all. So I showed it to her. And it happened to, well, this is her story, but it happened to be on a day when she had some conflict with her boss, and it would sort of, you know, fell at a time when it seemed like a good idea. And I and Shell kind of tried to recruit me after we were up interviewing for Susan, and we kind of then decided to, you know, maybe both look for positions at Amazon. So
So you got hired as an engineer. One of the first stories I'm going to ask about is book recommendations. Is that one of the first things you worked on, or was it a hodgepodge of projects?
No, that was a few months later. But I think from the start, it was just kind of working on website software. Not even anything specific, but there were just a bunch of things going that needed work, and I can't even point to anything. There were odds and ends, even just that were off to the side, like the customer service email queue at that time had grown to from maybe tens of messages to hundreds of messages to thousands of messages. And at the time, those messages were just stored as single files in an ordinary Unix file system, and in one directory, in a single directory. And so one of the things I did early on was just to split that up into multiple directories, just to keep it from crashing the file system. So, so there were little things like that. It's, there were challenges due to scaling. There were constant challenges due to scaling. And so there was a lot of just fixing little things that don't even seem like projects per se, but they're just to prevent the site from coming down, but basically keep the store running.
And in our pre-interview, you mentioned that you never really, or there were times when you felt like you didn't have a boss, but did you report into Shell?
Shell was.
Did it not matter as much because it's just like there were things that needed to get done?
People did have projects they were working on, but there was a lot of interruptions, no matter what you were working on, there were always emergencies. So, when I first started that, it was still very small and simple, but because of the growth, that things just started breaking right away. So, So I got some specific assignments early on, but they were, generally things that had to do with scaling. It wasn't until JJ started, and she was my manager working on the Bookmatcher project.
Okay.
That was actually in 97, I think. So,
a project area that you can think of as making better recommendations for customers, so that you can suggest books. That's a fair way to, and you approached it in two different ways. Is that right? Like the Bookmatcher was sort of third party software, and then you did a version of your own.
Well, the engine that drove Bookmatcher was a third party license from a company called GroupLens, or at least the product was called GroupLens. It was basically a way of collecting and matching up recommendations. So people could rate books, and then based on their ratings, they would get recommendations for other books.
Right.
And became a project that I was working on to build an interface on top of this engine that would be displayed on the website. And this was very early website software, so that we didn't have things like JavaScript. It was just strictly HTML pages.
Right.
So it was a very primitive kind of interface, but
so did everybody get asked the same 25 books? Like what? It was pretty clunky. Like it would
yes,
be. Do you
yes,
like Shakespeare?
That's,
do you?
That's like, how it started out, right? There was there would be the most popular books in a bunch of different categories, and then people would go through and rate them, and it ultimately was not a very successful product because it wasn't something that people really wanted to use. And it required an investment of time just to get recommendations, which most people aren't willing to do. So,
It was a pretty big barrier because you're saying, hey, fill out this 25-question survey. Sure. It's basically what it turns
exactly,
into.
Exactly, exactly. Like, do you have time for a 20-minute survey? It's like, no, I don't really want to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Only people who are curious, you know, basically, there are people who are just curious to try things, and they'll just go like, oh, let's try this survey, you know. But in general, people won't just do that because they're looking for a book.
Yeah, so that was the thing that was powered by GroupLens, which was a company called Net Perceptions. And for historical purposes, it was a group out of the University of Minnesota that had come up with it, and we licensed it that. And and the short version is it didn't work well. And we can talk a little bit about why.
Right.
But other than just the clunky interface where people had to answer 25 questions. So while you were building Bookmatchers, you also built a first version. Was it similar? Did you call it Similarities, or was that simultaneous, or did you?
I can't remember if it was called Similarities to begin with, but it quickly was labeled Similarities after it launched. But it was just the idea that we would use sales data to generate recommendations for books, and so it was a simple thing to add. It's the feature that you see on the detail pages that says people who bought this item also bought these other items, or readers who read this book also read these other books, that sort of thing. So, and it's sort of become at the time, I think it was when it was new, it caught on in a way that became sort of something that became part of the culture in a way that was a new thing, you know, that people talked about, you know, that there were like New Yorker cartoons based on it and some things like that. So.
Yeah, this thing knows me better than my husband. That's
right, right, right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And so, you mentioned. I'm gonna butcher this, but you mentioned that the one was sort of trying to do map you to a person and then recommend a book, and whereas this was like mapping many to many.
No, that's pretty much right. It's so the essence of the recommendation of the GroupLens engine was. It was trying to build a profile for you, the user, and then match you to the nearest other users that were like you. And then you could look at the books that the other users like you also liked. Right. So it was matching users to users. And then, but this Similarities, the way we built it was turned upside down or inside out, but basically it was matching items to items by using the users essentially you would take an item and you would find all the customers who purchased the item, and then you would find all the other items that those customers had purchased, and you'd rank those in order of popularity. And there were some modifications to that that were necessary, but ultimately that was the essence of the algorithm, and it worked surprisingly well.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming probably V1 was simply that, and probably V11 had other things in it, like what they rated the book after the fact. Did they return the book?
Yes, there were lots of there was a lot of looking at the results and sort of tweaking the algorithm to make it more useful or there were some things, there were kind of strange misleading things that happened, like Douglas Adams, who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There were a few books by Douglas Adams, and in the early days of the internet, of course, the books like that were more popular among the people who shopped on the internet. Yeah. But there was another author named Douglas Adams, and people who just wanted to buy everything that Douglas Adams wrote would buy this books by this other Douglas Adams. And usually return them and not be happy. They basically had made a mistake, but they didn't know it right when they made the purchase. And because we were using sales data, we actually started recommending this other Douglas Adams book on The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was, you know, something we had to avoid. So we had to start putting in special cases for things like that, where we could distinguish, you know, cases that we didn't want to recommend.
Yeah, Greg Linden, who is another engineer, gave me some other examples of that later on, where they would use it. I think it was for similarities, another later version, I forget what it was called across the site, mm-hmm. but like with electronics, they would recommend cables, and it would be a bad cable because it got in there somehow. And then a lot of people would buy that cable, right. which would mean it would recommend that cable to more people. So it's a similar problem, but just got extended as these recommendation technologies got spread across the website.
The similarities it's kind of created a feedback loop for some items where it actually increased sales for things that you wouldn't necessarily want to increase sales for.
And so why was similarities, I mean, if you had to sum it up, why was similarities that much better than, I mean, I guess Bookmatcher had the odds stacked against it because first it had the difficult to get, impossible to get people to fill out the 25 question survey. But then it's also, because it's limit trying to match a person to a person and everybody's saying they like Shakespeare, you know, I would assume it would just end up with the same recommendations. Whereas your individual item purchases over time is getting more and more dialed into what you're actually interested in, not what you say you're interested in.
So a bunch of things, but I think the number one reason that Bookmatcher didn't work as well is that there just wasn't enough data. And that because there was a lot of sales data, and so we got to use the sales data was constantly increasing. So and updated every day. So that was a great source because people had to engage in this activity to seed the engine. There was this overhead that was a barrier to entry, and because of that, there wasn't enough data, and
So similarities was kind of an early use of big data. I mean, it's a common term now.
I would say yes. It was, I think, the first time that at Amazon we used our sales data, basically created a feedback loop where we used the sales data to promote something on the site. That was the...
Right.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the first big example. I mean, Amazon, first of all, the differentiator from physical is just selection that was available, strong prices. But this was starting to get to that next level where we can do things at a physical store and the people in the stores can't do because they can't possibly have read all the books. Whereas here you're using the purchase information from all the customers to help find additional books that they'd be interested in buying based on all the other purchase data.
And conceivably, even a physical bookstore could have done that. But I doubt if they had the technology in place to do it. But they could have
swipe cards and loyalty programs.
Just using credit card data, and you know, maybe there would be ways. But it would have been very advanced in the 90s to try and do that. And the fact that we had that data in a way that was pretty easy to use. Ultimately, I mean, there are challenges in keeping it up to date. And we did a lot of things overnight. We computed the recommendations for the next day overnight, and in the long run there wasn't enough night to do all that, so we had to do it in a different way. But it started out as doing offline and just creating those databases
and that's an example of how you sort of had to build it and scale it and rebuild it on the fly, right? Because you built version one, where you're like, oh, we can do this overnight.
Yes,
and that worked for a couple of weeks or months. Yeah. And like, oh, wait a second, we can't do it overnight. So now we have to figure out a way to do it more continuously what I'm assuming.
And even in the beginning, I think, it started out, even at the launch, there was a weekly build and a daily overnight build. So there were some, over time I'm sure that just got to the point where it had to be continuous.
So I don't want to spend the whole time asking about the recommendations. It's just everybody can relate. Everybody can relate to it. But a few weeks ago, I interviewed Josh Peterson and Matt Round, who sort of worked, I think, a couple of years later after this launch. And along the way, I think Greg Linden, who was another engineer, I think he bridged it with something that was called instant recommendations. Was that different technologically, or was it just getting new placements like on the shopping cart, saying, hey, you have those two things in your cart. Maybe you want to add this third thing, or was it actually technologically different what he was doing with instant recs?
I think it was just different ways of exploiting the same data. So with the data that we had built, that the similarity, so associating items to other items, could be then used to generate recommendations in other contexts. Like you could see recommendations based on what's in your shopping cart or recommendations.
Right, because you haven't necessarily bought those items yet, but those items an item that you're looking at,
right.
You could say, yeah.
Or you could get recommendations based on your previous purchases. And I think we ended up doing this later on the front page when you come to the store, it would say, oh, based on your purchases, we think you would like this item. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I love how good it works when I've left something in my cart and they recommend it to me again. I'm like, how did they know?
Right.
Well, yeah, because
right.
I left it.
Sure.
I left it sitting in the shopping cart.
Right.
So, one last question on this then is, maybe you didn't have to worry about it with V1, but how did you reduce the impact of like new releases or really popular items like Harry Potter, you know, which again, that was later, but you know, how would you promote unusual items so that they showed up sometime and it wasn't just super popular item? Like, do you remember any of that? Or is that
I'm trying to remember. And I think that was an issue that we knew about and we started working on even in the very first version. And it was, let me see if I remember. Yeah. So we were expecting like, oh, well, aren't we just going to see the most popular items overall recommended? And so I think there was some bias given to try and filter out the most popular items. But I think what we realized was the very popular items would have other popular items recommended or associated with them. And the less popular items would have less popular items show up because of the nature of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you went to a really niche item, then the people that would want to buy that niche item also would buy a whole bunch of other niche items that would show
exactly,
up a lot more.
Exactly. Because they're buying based on their interests that might be not mainstream for whatever reason. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So jumping to another topic, which is web labs. Mm-hmm. So we talked about this during episode 10 with Josh Peterson and Matt Round.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you told me, did you build V1 of a web lab? And maybe if you built V1, do you know how many versions you built or did you hand it off immediately?
All I did was build the initial version, which was extremely primitive. And I honestly don't even know what happened next with that. It was essentially just, I don't know how much you want to cover this material, but it was also called A/B testing, where you could present different content to different users. So one set of users would see one version of the website and another set would see a different version of the website. And then you would compare their behavior.
Right.
So it was basically running an experiment where you look to see how those changes changed the way that they behaved
Was that a unique idea or is that something that you had worked on at a different company? Did it come from Did it come from Jeff?
Like, it was.
Where did the
It was something that was in the air, and I think that it was something that had always been talked about, not just for Amazon, but it's something that websites could do, and I don't think it was certainly wasn't unique to Amazon, and I don't know if anyone else had done it previously, but it wasn't a novel idea. It was just something that we knew because the nature of the internet was such that we could do something like that, where because we created a session ID for each user, and so each user when they came in would be identified, and then their pages would be identified with that session. Then we could separate some sessions into one group and other sessions into another group.
Yeah, and what's interesting, I mean, it's very similar to what we're talking about with book recommendations. It's not something that a physical store can do.
The store
is the same store for everybody.
Yes,
whereas.
Yes.
You know, you're interested in computer books and I'm interested in, I'm a parent who has interested in buying children's books where it should be a totally different experience. And that's that's an extreme version of long-term personalization. But this is just like, would a red button work better than a green button? Or, putting these things in different placements work better?
Exactly.
By the way, I did find out at least one story is that Peter Morse, who was a data, I think, analytics engineer, or I think he, I think was his title, yeah, manager web analytics. He said that he thinks the first A/B test was testing the color of the add to cart button on books detail pages, and that it had little to no impact. But he assured me that many future tests had massive impacts.
Sure.
And which I thought was interesting. And he's back at Amazon again.
Oh, that's
too
funny.
So, So what made building web just not going into excruciating detail, but what made it really difficult? Because I'm not trying to trivialize, but like for somebody listening, they say, well, they come in, you assign different session IDs, they get each one gets a different treatment, and then you look at all the what happened at the end, which one bought more, which one spent more time on the website. It's just massively difficult.
It's simple in concept. It's just difficult in execution for
right.
And the main, well, there are a lot of reasons, but because we had our systems in place for doing things like content creation and content management and site management and collecting logs and analyzing logs, all those things were hand-built. They were built in-house and on the fly, and they weren't high priority items. That was sort of infrastructure that was lower on the list. So the things that were high on the list were building new businesses, and the things like, you know, the basic structure of things was low on the list of priorities in the company.
Right.
So we had things that were essentially jury-rigged, one-off, things that we had built in-house and that worked, but were somewhat fragile, not flexible, not designed to be modified easily.
Right.
And so going through and changing every one of these elements to allow for multiple treatments and multiple sessions, different groups of sessions and so on, was challenging. And then even at the end, being able to take the results and do any analysis was also challenging.
Right. And so web labs and A/B tests, but was the terminology always like very, was it chosen for a reason? Like, because this is how experiments are run?
Yeah. Or? So I tried hard to use the terminology of scientific experiments to do it in a way that when we had, actual scientists designing experiments, that they would look at it and it would be familiar to them. The concept of creating an experiment where you would go from different treatments, and then dividing the users into treatment groups, and then looking at the results. So just using that terminology of calling it the web lab. So it's a laboratory, and you're doing experiments, and so that concept was sort of colloquially called A/B testing at the time, but I think I wanted to use that more scientific terminology. So.
Well, Peter Morse made the point that, and however it was decided, but that A/B testing was, he said, it confused some people because they thought that you could only do a version A and a version
B.
And, he sent me a funny picture that I'll include in the post, which was they had in their office, which had a switch for A and B. But really you could run 10 versions of a test it's not limited to one.
Yeah. And I guess another thing about scientific experiments is that you generally have a control group and then treatment groups. And in our world, in some cases there would be a control group, in the sense that it was that there wasn't any change compared to what it was before, but it doesn't exactly make sense to say there's a control group because the site was constantly changing anyway. So just changing it one way and then changing it another way. Anyway.
And customers didn't notice. And I mean, there's two questions here. Customers didn't notice it then. And I mean, right now, probably Amazon is running hundreds of web labs, we would assume, right? They're probably testing things everywhere.
Right.
But there's no impact when my mom's shopping on the site, she wouldn't notice any difference. It's just that behind the scenes, my aunt might be looking at an entirely different version of that web page, and you're aggregating all their results to to see which version converts better.
Sure. If you were an active shopper at Amazon and came to the site, you know, multiple times a week, say, you might notice the site was changing, but you wouldn't really know why it was changing. And you wouldn't know that you were getting something different than someone else who was using the same site. So
yeah, and now it's 24 years later. So when you think of the compounding effects of, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of web labs over the years, and hopefully not going too far in reverse on any of them, that's sort of where the advantages build up. And it becomes difficult for other websites to copy because they don't know which web labs are working or effective and which are ineffective.
Well, they can do their own if they have if they have that technology. There's nothing magic about the technology we were using. I mean, in fact, it was it was very primitive, and I don't know what state it's in now. But anyone can do it. There's nothing that difficult inherently difficult about it, but. Then using what you do with it once you have that is something else. And I also think there is an issue that you can make short-term decisions that make sense based on the data you have, but you don't know that is smart in the long term. Like if you do too many things that optimize, the sort of the concept of reaching a local maximum, where there's a global increase that you would miss out on because you've reached a local maximum, and because you're making many small changes to optimize people's behavior, but then not realizing that in optimizing their short-term behavior, you may be alienating them in the long run.
So like something like you could be really optimizing the book experience, but you're not introducing them to the music and video categories, and so it limits the overall or long-term. Is that a good example?
I was thinking more than the problem of just if you just aggressively market, if you aggressively sell things on the site, if you just if I put these three images on the site, then it's better than if I put two images, and now, if I put five images on the site, then it's even better. And then ultimately, like what happens is that people just get burned out because there's too much clutter and you don't realize it because you say, oh, but if I put another image, then people like it better. Yeah. So people pay more, people spend more because there are more things to click on, that sort of thing. So,
So in, I think it's related. So early on, all of the detail pages, a product page, was kind of hard-coded, right? And in order to run an A-B test, you kind of have to be able to dynamically serve one version of the page and the other. Was catsups used for that? And if so, can you maybe give some background about what catsups was? And then, I think Paul Davis built it. He was a engineer number two.
Right.
But, and I think that's related to web labs, but tell me if it...
it was one element that you could use in creating different content for different users. But catsups was just a template system. And if you're working in building HTML pages, this is going back to the 90s. Basically, HTML pages were static, code that would generate the content on a page. Pages like detail pages were the product pages were dynamically generated from a database, from a customer, from an item database, basically.
Right.
We needed to be able to make dynamic substitutions into those pages. And so catsups was basically just a way of putting marks in the HTML files that would notify the software that serves it on the site that they had to make substitutions based on looking up something in a database.
I guess that was another project that you had, which was to improve catsups. Is that fair to say?
Yes. So, Paul Davis had built a simple version of this for the initial site. And it was kind of slow and kind of limited and had a very, very small set of commands you could use to make substitutions on the page. And at the time that we launched music, we started to need more capability. And, you know, I think it had started before that, but it became an imperative. It turned into a project that got assigned resources, I should say.
What's an example of a command? What's an example of one or two commands that so people can understand what you mean, like what it was able to do versus what it needed to be able to do as you added new categories?
Well, so typical thing. Well, even if you look at something like similarities, so if you're looking at a detail page, you'll see, say, an image of a product, and you'll see the name of the product, and you'll see the price, and so on. All those things are looked up in a database, and there would be commands to show those values on the page. So that there were basically markers in the cat subs language would say, you know, show the price or show the, you know, so on. And then when we added similarities, we had to do the same thing with similarities. Right. So yeah. So more and more there were things that had to be computed and built on the fly. And right. So I guess we experimented with things like, we wanted to show, we were deciding whether showing three similar items or five similar items would be more useful. And So we, you know, anyway, we needed to be able to do, you know, change those easily without having to write a lot of code. So.
And I would assume all of these things are slowing. Every time you're adding some fancy new recommendation or similarity or just content overall, it's slowing these pages down. Is that fair to say or no?
Yes. There's more work you have to do than for every page. Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the simplest HTML page, it's just copying from a file on the web server. It's just copying those out to the network, and then everything that you do that's different on the page, like, you know, for the customer or for the item, involves database lookups or mm-hmm. other work on the server side before you can then generate that data to send out to the network.
And in hindsight, I mean, do you think your modifications were the right ones at the time? Do you think it should have been done differently?
Yeah.
It's not really criticizing anyone. It's just more of a looking back on it now and you're like, boy, we really would have saved a lot of pain had we, you know, done something a little differently earlier on.
I think many things were done early on with a sense of expediency, like that they were just, you know,
right.
What we have to do to get things working right now. And we don't have a lot of time to think about it. And, and cat subs was definitely one of those things that we knew was not the right solution, but it was a solution that worked at the time. And, I think that the problem with cat subs, I mean, there were performance issues. That wasn't the biggest problem though. The biggest problem with cat subs was essentially it was creating a very sort of primitive programming language for people to write, to create those pages, to create those templates. Mm-hmm. And there was always a separation that, you know, there was code that professional programmers wrote that was running on the system and written in a language like C or C++ at that time, and other languages later, but at that time it was C and C++. And then there were things like the pages, like the HTML, which was developed by the content team, which was not professional programmers. There were people whose job was to lay out elements on the page, and so they were more in the area of design than in programming. And we had to give them a way to make those customizations, but that we were deliberately trying to make it not be a programming language.
Right.
But ultimately you need the power of a programming language to get that job done.
Yeah.
And so it ended up being a very poor programming language, essentially.
which lived for a very, very long time.
And
right?
Because it was not an established programming language that people could learn about outside of Amazon, it became sort of a dark art that people learned when they joined the content creation team.
Yeah, you couldn't just go hire experts or people that worked on something that was very similar. No, there was one of those things that was a,
One of the jokes that went around was somebody had mocked up an O'Reilly book about cat subs, you know, just the cover of the book, you know, just as a joke. And it's like, there is no O'Reilly book about cat subs.
That's kind of what was needed.
Exactly. So,
So making a big jump, we haven't talked about the switch from the company from Unix to Linux. It's a gigantic change.
Right.
Could you maybe just give a short background on, you know, what things were and, and the no one's talked about it yet. I just found it interesting and I traded some mails with people and said Eric would be the one of the good people to talk to about that. So maybe just explain it to people why it was really important and how it came to be.
And, you know, you have to kind of look back to the history of the internet and, you know, hardware systems at that time. It was in the mid 90s at the when Shell started development on Amazon, you know, version one in 1994, it was on Sun workstations, which was a sensible choice at the time. And Sun had their own version of Unix. And so the software was built using using that version of Unix. It was Sun OS at the time. And but then I think really just before I started, so not long after the launch, it was moved from Sun OS to Digital Equipment Corporation, Digital Unix, which is another company that no longer exists. But but yeah, so at the time, the Digital Unix systems were they were built on a 64-bit processor, so they had the opportunity to scale up. We thought maybe to would scale up better. And we used the Digital Unix and its successors from that time until the year 2000. And the problem was that by that time, we had gone from one server, one piece of hardware to, I guess, by that time, it must have been thousands, I guess. I don't really know the exact numbers, but, you know, it went from one to three to dozens to hundreds to, you know, so, and at any rate, there were many, many servers. So the hardware costs were significant. And because it was a small manufacturer and there were powerful machines, the cost per unit was very high. So that was, and then we had, so the company knew that we had to do something about that. And we had an opportunity to make a major purchase from HP. And this was early in 2000. And so in order to take advantage of that, we had to either get the software running on Windows, which was would have been almost impossible to do, either that or get it running on Linux, which at the time was still an unusual choice, but starting to get more popular as a server software. And it, much later, it became sort of a standard for server software, but it was still an unusual choice. But so basically we decided we needed to port our software from Digital Unix to Linux running on on inexpensive PC hardware, which is what HP was offering. So, and in the process, we would be saving, and I don't know the numbers, but it was saving a significant amount on each unit of computation.
Actually, I'll jump in there because I looked today.
Oh, good.
There was a CNET article, and this was in May 2002, so it was already a year after. But they said that they reported in a quarter the change cut technology expenses by about 25% from $71 million to $54 million. Hmm. And then just think to ripple that through 20 years and explosive growth in AWS. So likely save billions of dollars from that painful project or not. so jumping back to then making it work, was did you Did you get it running locally? And like, how did you even figure out that it was possible?
Well, it started as maybe a year earlier. I had just as a sort of, you know, just a Skunkworks kind of thing, like a personal curiosity, I had tried to port the software to run on Linux myself on one machine to see if it could possibly work. And I was able to do it, and I didn't pursue it because it was not considered a priority at the time.
Right.
But I basically got this thing running, and I said, "Hey, look, this works, and it's not done, but it works well. It's clearly going to work if we want to do this.
It's functioning.
Yes.
It's not like not functioning.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so when this opportunity came along to purchase hardware, and it became clear that running on Linux was the only way to take advantage of it. It was basically a team of two software engineers. That was me and Bob Badney, who I had mentioned earlier was responsible for the database when we had that outage. So the two of us pretty much spent the entire year 2000 on just making sure that our software actually worked on both systems during that entire year. So everything that the large team of software engineers was doing had to work on both systems. And because people were developing entirely on digital Unix, they were essentially unaware. They had no way to test that their software was working on Linux. So I had to go through essentially multiple times a day and just make changes to every piece of code that was checked into the system to make it, to keep it running, to keep it working on Linux during that entire year. So, so it was sort of a constant, it was like running on a treadmill, to just keep things going through that year. And in the meantime, Bob was working on all the pieces surrounding it having to do with, deployment. So there were a lot of scripts and, you know, just pieces of code that were involved in just deployment, basically getting software from the development servers to test servers to the production servers and so on, right. and collecting logs and all the just things that, you know, kept the site running, not the core software. So I was basically working on the core software, and Bob was working on all the other pieces of the system. And
then did we just turn it over, like flip it all over? Was it we'll roll a percentage of our traffic and see how it works, or did it just work out of the gate?
So at the end of that year, we started to get some hardware in, and then we started at that point, we flipped not the entire system all at once, which, you know, would have been a recipe for disaster. Right. But yeah, I think it was, and I don't know what the percentages were, but yeah, we started routing some of the traffic to the Linux servers, like at the point where we thought that the Linux system was working in the same way as the digital Unix system, then we ran traffic over there and it started working. And so it wasn't very long after that we completely switched over. It wasn't, you know, there really, once you get to that point, there's no point in keeping both of them running.
That's when you want to run as fast as possible and fix any issues.
Exactly.
And stop supporting the
sooner you can,
the digital
you can
Unix
decommission
version.
The old system. It's
That's
better
great.
It's going to be. Yeah.
So we're running out of time.
Okay.
I thought we have to talk about Rufus at least for a minute or two.
Yeah.
Maybe just quickly tell the story about Rufus and site launches, which is one of my earliest memories, you know.
Sure.
And yeah.
Well, so the story of Rufus. Well, so Rufus was our dog in San Francisco before we came to Seattle, and when you know, Susan and I it was just the two of us and our dog. When we started at Amazon, it was we knew it was going to be long days at the office, and we were working in a building that was not very fancy, in fact, pretty low key. We just talked to Jeff about, you know, it would be okay to bring the dog to work. That was sort of the essence of it. Is it okay if we bring Rufus to work? And Jeff said, is he a good dog? which was a funny, funny thing to say. But and we said, yeah, he's a good dog. And generally, he was a good dog.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Rufus came to the office nearly every day for the time that we worked there. He kind of became the company mascot, and he would wander from office to office and go to meetings and, you know, just hang out and
yeah. Well, I heard didn't he have to get written into one of the leases for one of the buildings as an exception?
Yes.
Because later dogs are everywhere, but I guess early on they were in a building where it wasn't allowed.
Yeah. So we moved from the Soto office to the Columbia building downtown. And that was also not a very fancy building, but the landlords really didn't want to have any pets in there.
That building was awful. They had no right banning anything from
building. I know, but but they really didn't want to have pets in there, and there, you know, fears of liability if someone got bitten, and you know, those things. So the landlords asked Amazon to sign a waiver to hold them harmless if anything happened because of the dog. Now, the funny thing is, then Jeff asked Susan and I to sign a waiver so that Amazon would be held harmless. Anyway, so, you know.
Did you actually sign that?
Yeah, sure. It's like, Rufus.
That's
Rufus
funny.
Didn't, you know.
Yeah, I get it.
Well, felt pretty confident.
And
about
then the
Rufus.
One other story is that Rufus used to push the button to launch
versions of
the website. Rufus, how often did that happen?
Rufus was the mascot. So everybody loved Rufus. Right. And you know, switching the site over became a big thing that, you know, we did late at night, and you know, we would usually go out to dinner afterwards and things like that. So it was kind of a big deal when that happened.
Right.
And I think it might have been Mariam Mohit, who I think you probably have talked to, and
yeah, we've interviewed him already.
I think she might be the one who said, "Hey, let's get Rufus to switch the site," you know, and so you know, and of course Rufus was just there, so you know, that just basically meant picking up his paw and having it push the button on the keyboard.
I was there for a few of those. I was there for the music one, video one, and auctions. And so, it's a pretty vivid memory. And we have a photo of one of those, and I think Mariam uploaded it. So I'll copy it over on your episode
nice,
as well.
Nice.
And there's a building named after Rufus down in South Lake Union, right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, you should demand payment for that.
I know, right?
Show your contract.
And the entire, like, there was a whole building project that was called Rufus 2.0.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Awesome. So, JJ Jacoby, who we mentioned earlier, Amazon engineer you worked with before. So she said about you, a standout area that resonates in my memory about Eric was how he mentored engineers. There was so little time to do that. He always made time for newer engineers that wanted to discuss systems, languages, projects they were designing.
Right.
And she just wondered if that stood out for you, because she said it helped people build up during a time of heavy growth. And then I'll add, probably at a time we had very little formal training. Is that something you gravitated to?
And absolutely. That was something that I, you know, I think I, yeah, exactly, gravitated towards. And to the point where I think for most of the, like, the third and fourth years that I was there, that was essentially my job. I didn't really have any other projects. Right. It wasn't until my fifth year that we did the Linux project. And that was, you know, heads down, really didn't do anything else. But really in my third and fourth years, what I was doing was I was just a resource, basically a source of knowledge about how systems worked in the company.
Right.
And, you know, so whenever someone was launching a new part of the site or, you know, on a different platform or for whatever reason, you know, they were doing something new.
Right.
They would come to me and say, "Well, how would you do this?" And so I'd sort of like help them think through. So I did a lot of brainstorming on how to, you know, add new features to the site and so on.
And part of that was probably just because you had touched every part of the site as it built from, you know, the early version that Shell and Paul built to something that got increasingly complicated. But these new people were coming in with none of that background. Is that part of it?
I think
as well?
That's right. And just, you know, right. So I'd just been there, just kind of it built so many things on, you know, so many parts of the system over time. I mean, I think the web lab was probably a good example of that, where because it touched every phase of the system. And, you know, right. But yeah, there were just a lot of different pieces, and there was a lot of, you know, sort of arcane knowledge, I guess you could say, that, you know, people needed to get their job done. And there, you know, there wasn't any way to just know about it. Someone had to tell you. And so, yeah.
So I don't think the term existed. You mentioned about we accumulated a lot of technical debt over the years, but that's because we had to build it all. Like there was that Oracle database and was what Shell and Paul built in that first sprint. But then you were sort of building while you were scaling, while you were fixing, you know, like it's nice to say you should have done it differently or more elegantly, but was there a different way to do it really, given how fast just everything was growing?
Yeah. I think that, speed was the first thing that everybody wanted, you know, speed and growth. So things had to happen fast, and they, you know, we had to just deal with whatever came our way. And we didn't have any products we could buy to solve those problems. We had to build everything. So, I mean, most companies go through this build or buy decision. You know, am I going to spend money on some IT system, or am I going to just buy people and build something in house that will do it? Well, you know, no, you can't. There weren't any products to purchase to scale websites at the time. So we just
One you did buy didn't work for the situation. You know, the one we started the interview talking about. Not that there was anything wrong with what they did, but it probably didn't work at scale. Didn't work because of the user interface. Didn't work for a lot of reasons. And so
So I was thinking later, during the year when I was working on Linux, it was also like Amazon was getting pretty large by that time, and I started getting calls from people I had worked with in the Bay Area, and they were now at companies selling products to do building websites or scaling websites or things like that, and they were trying to say, oh, Amazon should buy this product, and every single one of them I looked at and went, this is a toy, you know, compared to what we're doing. Right. Yeah. So like, yeah, your product might work for somebody who's doing something tiny, but it's useless to us. So even at the point where there were products like that, they wouldn't have been applicable to us. So.
One thing I heard from people was that in the beginning, it was a little bit difficult to recruit engineers. And this is going a little bit off our planned topic, but it just made me think of it. Like they said it was a little bit, maybe it was Joel or Kim. I forget exactly. Yeah. Dwayne and Rubin, I think, mentioned. And they were like, it was a little hard to recruit engineers because in the early days, it wasn't seen as there was a lot of, you know, I don't know, sexy problems being addressed from an engineering perspective. Sure. Were you there from that? And like, how did that change? Like it did pivot over time where it became a very attractive place to work.
Yeah, I do remember that. And then thinking, I think that essentially building database applications, you know, the CRUD applications, you know, which,
right.
Anyway, just like the things that would just, you know, where you're buying a product and, you know, putting an entry in a ledger essentially, and, you know, shipping products to people, that was considered sort of drudgery, you know, like people wrote COBOL code to do those things. And so what we were doing was basically solving old problems, but in new ways. But it wasn't considered glamorous. I mean, a place like Microsoft was much more interesting to people at that point because, you know, they were building, you know, operating system software and compilers and development systems and all those things. So,
yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, we hit an hour again without even thinking about it. Actually, I want to like to end on, you know, lessons for entrepreneurs. I mean, in this case, I think a big part of it wasn't about technology. I mean, you just were dealing with, it just sounds like you're telling these stories and like, I don't know, they actually do seem like sexy projects to me, like the recommendations and, you know, and the Linux transition must have been like a heroic thing. But like, if you're talking to younger entrepreneurs or even innovators inside companies, what do you think the lesson is? It's like, how did you guys stay focused in the midst of all the chaos? Like, was it just make customers happy? Like, was there something about the Amazon mission that really appealed to you and the people that you admired at the company?
I think, well, once I think it was easy to get sort of caught up in the, you know, the excitement of the moment. I think we did have a sense that we were changing the world, and the hyper growth that was happening, it was hard to deal with, but it was very exciting too, because, you know, we were going from a tiny company to a huge company. And, you know, I mean, I could not have imagined what would happen today. You know, that's like, it's gone to a whole different level. But anyway, but yeah, it was very exciting. Once, I mean, I often say, well, I moved from San Francisco to Seattle and joined a cult. You know, it was sort of like, it had that feeling where I didn't really have much awareness of the city I lived in. I was just going to this place every day, and we were just immersed in it. And you know, there were just so many problems to solve every day. We didn't, you know,
Yeah. I mean, it must have been really, I mean, I got there in 98. So after everything was already pretty popular, you know,
it was
lots of news coverage, both good and bad, but it must have been pretty exciting though, getting there in 96. And then when that New York Times article hit in 97, I think, and you know, you started getting like, just like, oh my God, this is just everything you're planning for.
Yeah.
You're like, you'll plan for 4X growth, but 2 months later you're at 4X growth and you have rethink it. It must have been
moments,
so exciting.
Like there was a 60 Minutes story about Amazon. Right. A lot of this stuff happened in 99 and 2000. There was a 60 Minutes story. I remember Jeff was on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He was Man of the Year in 99, I think. And so on the Time Magazine, Man of the Year. So there were all these things that, you know, where we'd gone from virtually like nothing, like this tiny, tiny business in this little shop. And anyway, so and then it was like, wow, what's happened? You know, like you turn around and like,
yeah, that's back.
Yeah.
That's back when the interviews were all very popular and positive, and they
It. And it's like, wow, this is such a great thing.
I remember, Barbara Walters, you know, interviewing Jeff and stuff. And I always tell the story, like, because that Second Avenue building was so small, you'd like be walking down the hallway, and like Stephen King would be coming out of your wife's office. Like it was, you know what I mean? It was really fun, just because it was just so compressed. You know, doing interviews in the stairwells. Like as bad as that is, it's still also good memories as well. It was a very compressed group, you know?
Yeah. We're just caught up in the whirlwind and
Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much for being my guest on the podcast. You know, I think people are going to love hearing these stories. I mean, literally, I think your names come up on almost every episode, especially, you know, even with the pre-episode chats with people like Greg Linden and others. So I was glad to be able to get some more details on those. And you know, it was also just great to see you. It's been a long time since we've been in Seattle.
Okay. Well, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. And for the audience, thank you for listening to the Invent Like an Owner podcast. If you'd like more details about what we discussed or want to contact me with edits, please visit inventlikeanowner.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. That's it for today. Remember, no sniveling.